pictures from their experiments.
Wesley?
Yes.
Okay. I read the article. Number one, it's not an antenna. It's two antennas. If you read closely, he has an antenna which sounds a lot like a traveling wave low efficiency antenna, because he says that the length of the antenna is not that important. The only time that's the case is not with standing waves and you need resonance, but in traveling waves. So sounds like the 3 megahertz to 30 megahertz portion of that device is a traveling wave antenna. He also includes a discone, which is designed for UHF and VHF. So, in fact, it is not a 3 megahertz to 440 megahertz antenna. It's a 3 to 30 megahertz traveling wave antenna hooked together with a discone set up for UHF and VHF. So that's what the article itself said.
Right. I do agree with you. So it is the traditional HF vertical antenna and the extended discone antenna. The HF vertical is used from 160 meters to 6 meters, and the antenna for VHF and above is placed on the top and uses HF vertical conductor as the surface wave transmission line. You don't like the surface wave word. Let me drop. So that SWTL is feeding the line. Anyhow, so now do we agree that this antenna is proudly documented and it should work? And I also sent that information to Jeff. I would be very much pleased if Jeff would like to say a few words about it.
I assume you mean AC2PL?
Correct.
Okay. Jeff, if you're out there and you'd like to comment, once again, my gestalt of this is that it may very well match, as long as you keep in mind that, once again, it appears to be a traveling wave antenna, which does not provide the efficiencies of a standing wave. Traveling waves can be any length long, and they won't give you a high return loss because they burn up all of the power at the end of their antenna. So there's no reflected energy that an SWR meter would detect, and so it will tell you that you have a perfect match. A lot of times that's a meaningless concept. It's not like they're checking to see if you have a 50-ohm impedance. The SWR meters don't directly measure impedances. They measure the percentage of reflected power versus forward power. So keeping that all in mind, I mean, you too could have a folded dipole that's capable of giving you good SWR for the entire range. A lot of people won't hear you because the efficiency is so poor, but it does exist. People build them, people use them, and again, because you don't need efficiency in many cases, you get by. But once again, Jeff, if you're out there and would like to comment about the article, please feel free. Well, I assume Jeff is not with us tonight or not able to get into the repeater. We do have our two Canadian repeaters like we did last week. We have Barrie, Ontario, and Lake of Bays, Huntsville, Ontario, which is nice to see both of them linking in via IRLP. Hope I hear eventually someone from there using the repeater. Usually the repeaters are kind of timed to link with us and then timed to de-link with us. I don't think I've heard anyone from those repeaters on the technical net for at least 3 years. Anyway, Wes, it appears that Jeff is not available for comment at this time.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, the only additional comment on it is from 50 ohm to 377 ohms, so you need charging the device that would cover it depends from the frequency that you're working at. What else? No comments. It's a good design. I like it very much. And Twitch Chair.
Okay. I like all antennas. It's always nice to try and figure out how they worked. It would be nice if in the article he mentioned it was a traveling wave antenna. I'm drawing the conclusions based on the description of the characteristics that pretty much would indicate. But either he did not feel it necessary to discern the difference between traveling and standing wave antennas, he just didn't think it was of that much value, so he passed on it. I don't know. Interesting. I mean, if anyone out there is a member of the ARRL, you can read the technical magazine QEX for free on a iPad or a computer screen. The electronic version is free to all subscribers. So I would suggest you check it out at least. You know, usually there's one or two articles that isn't electrical engineering degree worthy, so the average person can benefit from reading it. There was some very good articles 6 years or so back about a gentleman who tested the number of radials required for a ground-mounted vertical and, you know, try to put to bed the never-ending argument among people of exactly how many radials do you need and how long do they have to be. So that was an interesting series of articles.
Okay. So, the other things, we could discuss that antenna, but you may as well leave it for the next week and have Jeff available for us for the comment, because I was really interested with his point of view. Anyhow, the other information are kind of episodic, if I could name it this way. It's like what is nice to know. Okay, so I was talking last week about a very clever SWR meter with a power meter that used directional coupler. I was kind of puzzled how low the directional couplers could go, and then I was surprised that there are so many directional couplers that goes to single kilohertz range. 9 kilohertz is not a big deal whatsoever. But anyhow, the company that made that special product was in New Jersey, and a Signal Crafters is the name, still the name of the company. And I was kind of surprised how come they were able to make such a nice thing at the time, which has a DC output, SWR power independent out of the back of the unit, the antenna 1, antenna 2 relays. And why do they use the relays? What the relays are for? And it was because it was some couplers could look like a transformer with some tops on it that you can switch using relays or switches. Anyhow, because I have a whole line of products from Signal Crafters that I'm using for VLF, but they were using it for PLC before, then I went to the history of that product, and I found out that that small company that started from ham radio product evolved to work with Japanese Yuhasa as a team at present time, but it wasn't really the Signal Crafters, but it was a company that was used by Signal Crafters to deliver parts. So the name of the company is... Heliomast. Heliomast is about the mast. So what that has to do with the antennas and ham radio operators? Well, they were making a lot of products in with that signal crafters from New Jersey. And today they are making a pretty nice thing that ham radio operators are using. But I'm going to go to that a little bit later. Okay. Now, it appears that the directional coupler used by signal crafters was made in England. And that company name is CTS England. They make so much of different devices, including antenna tuners that could be mounted directly at the mast of the antenna, big one, and also for the military, for police, and whatsoever. But so there would be, if somebody wants to use it, CTS England, they're going to find out that directional coupler that goes to 2 kilowatts from 1 to 30 kilohertz, 1 to 30 megahertz. But they can go also anything you want. You go to that webpage, I sent you that, and you have so many different products, it would be a lot of time to talk about it. So let's go back to... by the way, when we're talking about directional couplers, Mini Circuits from Brooklyn has a product, do-it-yourself for low-cost directional couplers. You have a link to, so in other words, is somebody who wants to experiment with it, it's, $5, whatever it is, and you can buy and make it by yourself and play it with yourself. Okay. Now, when we come back to the Heliomast, I believe it's Ohio, those guys, Heliomast LLC. Now, I sent you a number of videos, you don't have to look at those videos, but I try to make them to open exactly at the particular product they have. So they actually make masks. The good thing about it is they have a special mask for ham radio amateurs, also for the police, also for the military, also for probably for law enforcement. So in other words, it's a mask that retracts itself or retracts manually. It depends what version do you have. And it could go to 36, 40, 50 feet in height. It does have a very clever way of making the base for it. Actually, the base has something that you can write your left or right tire of your car on it and gives you a steady, steady foundation for the mast. So actually, you take your that mask from your back of your car, you put it to stand, you put your tire, actually, you drive your car just to the side of that mask, and now, a few minutes later, you have your mask up there. So this is good for any kind of antenna, and it's quite rigid. Okay, any comments? Maybe Dr. Roy have a comment for that particular one.
No, Wes, not anything in particular. I mean, if anyone else has any comments, please feel free.
Okay. Then they made a very much similar product. Having on the top instead of the antenna, the PTZ camera for surveillance that would be good for the police, but also for some guys who have a need to have a quick way to launch the camera in any place that would be, if you have apple trees or anything else to see, or in the area when you have a bird or wild animals, that is good. For hunting is good, although I'm still completely against hunting. So that is, and it's quiet, extremely quiet. It could be operated from the small battery or from the car battery if you want, or could be manually retracted. Then they have another one, which is the mechanical square mass series. This one is serious. It also could be used by ham radio operators, but it's really serious. This thing depends from the version, could go to 70 feet up. I'm not sure if, because it shows the large plate at the bottom of it, I'm not sure if that plate is also for the car or two cars to nail it temporarily to the ground so it doesn't. But talking about the height, if something pushes on the top or the strong wind, I'm not so sure if a car could hold it.
Okay, G2R1.
Yes, David.
Go ahead.
You know, I've been listening for a while. I still didn't figure out what this all of this means. And is there any significance, you know, for understanding ham radio?
Well, if you have a mask for the antenna, you have a mask for the antenna. All you need is an antenna. Maybe Dr. Roy has his own opinion about it.
No, I really don't. David kind of asked you, you know, in what way should he incorporate this information? And since you're presenting it, you might as well tell him.
Right, so we're talking about a mask. A company that makes a mask, this mask I also use for ham radio operators, and they are retractable. It's nothing more. I'm just talking about different versions of those masks they have. They also have a mask. So it was a very small company a few years ago, and they grew up. They also were making antennas for ham radio, and they grew up right now to work with the Japanese Yuhasa, and they made the hydraulic mask. They are also big in, if you see those TV trucks, having the portable transmitters, transmitting the vans whatsoever, they have the mask on their vans. Those masks are likely made by the helium mask. And so it looks like a small company that started somewhere in 2000, grows up right now to the size or to the reputation in the world where many countries are purchasing their products. So, but the reason that I said about it is just it's good to know about it. As I said at the beginning, some things good to know about it. If you need, you have it. You give them the call, and they have something for you.
So I just want to tell you, first of all, you know, I have a wire antenna. Wire antenna, it gets out. You know, people can hear it, you know. There are people that I've spoken to that have gotten a kind of sore lip, you know, sore, how to say. They didn't like the idea that I had a good signal and it was done with a wire antenna. 100 watts and a wire antenna. You know, I don't think I would ever need, you know, large paraphernalia, you know. I have a lot of great QSOs with a very simple, minimal system.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's wonderful. But some people want to have inherited V. They are not that lucky at this particular location. They want to work from RVs from time to time. Or people who just don't have the other way to make this antenna on the air. So if you have a inverted V or you have a dipole and you don't have a tree, so let's say you mount it on your house from one side and from the other side you don't have anything to mount at, now you have it. Now some of the people want to have from time to time with their vertical antenna, whatever kind of antennas they have, elevated high up. Some people want to use the Yagi, but normal Yagi is humongously visible, and sometimes it's not good. So let's say they launch it, they make a QSO, and they put it down. The retraction for 30 feet, it takes less than 1 minute. Some of those masts are belt operated. So it's like there is a belt. So it's quite rigid. Instead of the metal rope, or how do you call it, metal wire that usually was used in the cheap one, this one has the belt. So it's extremely quiet and extremely fast. Now, if you want to have a 50-footer or a little bit higher, I would say it's good to have a good foundation for it if you want to mount it. But anyhow, it's an idea. Enter here.
Yeah, I think it would be good to understand that, yes, it is possible to take the challenge, have a simple radio, wire antenna, small vertical, and work the world, you know, from propagation, you know, FT-891, or you get an IC-71, you pick your antenna somewhere, and you have your experiment, and you have your challenge, and, you know, I find that very satisfying.
Right, I agree with you. Another company, LF Engineering CO. So LF Lima France Engineering. What do you do? Well, I'm in VLF. They have a number of antennas. It's a small company, but what was surprising for me, 300 hertz to 30 kilohertz. Wow, it's good for Schumann resonance, lower harmonics. So we're talking actually upper harmonics. So we're talking about 7.85 hertz. It's a fundamental of Schumann resonance. And then we're talking about 300 hertz. It starts quite good stuff. And they have characteristic of it. They have the impedance of the antenna and how to match it with 50 ohm, which is good. You can imagine that if you have a coil, let's say you have a coil. The coil is 10 feet long or 5 feet long. And at the very bottom you have a zero impedance. You move your slider, so let's say you slide the wire through that coil in the way that it's touching the winds till you reach your 50 ohm. So, I also sent you, Dr. Roy, one way that's from the video, from the lecture. that was Lecture 101, I believe, when the guy is presenting everything about the directional couplers, anything actually about the impedance matching, and that video starts from that very much point. So in other words, I was puzzled how you can impedance match the antenna, any antenna to any impedance, any impedance of the antenna to any impedance you want. It doesn't have to be 50 ohm. And the guy says, imagine that you have a coil. On the very top, you have a very, very, very high impedance. On the very bottom, you have a zero impedance. You take your wire, and you slide through that coil. If, of course, if they can contact with the coil, right? And till you reach the dome. No brainstorm needed. Now, from the other side of it, you can do the same. So you can quickly match the, use it not only as the trans match between the antenna between your transmitter and another antenna, but you could use it also as an antenna alone. I'm not sure if I have perfectly clear said what I wanted to say, Dr. Roy.
Well, you know, it's kind of difficult for me to know if that's what you wanted to say, what I perceived you were saying. You're talking about different ways of doing impedance matching. There are an almost infinite number of different ways to transform impedances. You could look up an electrical engineering book, and the circuits involved in impedance matching or transformation are very abundant. And then there are simple component ways. There's all kinds of interesting ways. So you were just talking, as far as I was able to perceive, of a means to impedance match and transform such that it matches.
Right. So I have a loop antennas, the magnetic loop antennas too. And the good thing about this company, LF Engineering Company, Lima Frank Engineering Company, is that they give you on their website a price for it. If you want antenna from 300 hertz to 30 kilohertz, you're going to be paying to $480 for it, and they give you characteristic, and it's, of course, you can drive it from 50 ohms. You could have an antenna that looks like a vertical rubber duck, which is also start from 10 kilohertz to 530 kilohertz, and it's $275. And then there is a number of antennas. You could have the low-frequency active loop antenna in your hand, too, and, of course, there is a price for it. So for some guys who are looking for a little bit ecstasy in life, I'm not saying, no, this is not the proper word. It's like something that is kind of rare in ham radio, then this company is good, those products are good. They have also amplifiers, pre-amplifiers. For those who want to use, let's say, if you have the regular amplifier for audio, it works from 0 to 20 kilohertz, but most of them high quality that works. You cannot hear the sound, but they work to 150 kilohertz, 300 kilohertz, and more. So for those, if you connect a preamplifier to it and the antenna, now you're turning it to the receiver of ELF, if you want to. I believe that's all. I don't have anything else that I see. So thank you very much, and back to you, Dr. Roy.
Okay. Thank you very much, Wesley. I appreciate your participation on the TechNet, as usual. So I thank you very much. Anyone else with any questions or comments for tonight, please tell me your name and your call sign.
WP2 Alpha. 2BXO, Frank. How you doing?
Okay, two people doubled. I was able to hear Frank, and also he's on Echolink. So, you know, I mean, we quick hearers often lose track of people on Echolink. So the other gentleman that I didn't quite get his entire call sign, hold on for a little moment. And first we'll go to Frank, and then we'll go to you. So, Frank, what can I do for you tonight?
All right, Roy, if you like, why don't you identify the other station so he knows he'll get a turn, and then I'll go ahead, okay?
Okay, very good, Frank. The other gentleman, please go ahead.
Yeah, this is Chad. I just wanted to make a comment about an antenna, Whiskey Bravo 2 Alpha Hotel Kilo.
Sure, Chad.
All right, so I think it was W2KW Allen. I don't know him. I'd like to meet him someday. I'm Chad. Back in the 70s and 80s, I was on repeaters. And in the early 80s, I switched over to back over. I had room finally for HF antenna again. And I bought a Waters B&W all-band antenna. This version was 80 feet long. They had two versions, 80 foot long and 100. Let me let it drop a second. All right. So anyhow, I wasn't listening to HF for many years because I was 10 years on repeaters at UHF and VHF and had no comparison. In other words, like, I didn't have any other antennas to compare the Waters P&W antenna. But I could tell you that I put that thing on the air. It had a little round tube in the middle sealed with a coax dropping down like a G5RV. And boy, I was getting that all over the place. It was such a wonderful antenna. Oh, man, all the bands, 10 meters to 80. And so one cold winter day, there was an ice storm, and I ran a kilowatt, and the thing in the middle blew up. As Alan said, there wasn't nothing much inside it, like a thing in the middle. I think it was just a resistor. Hold on 1 second. So I looked at the remnants, and it was a large resistor. So I said, oh, gee, I blew my antenna up. I had to build a new one. So I said, what could I build? So I had the thing in operation for, let's say, 3 months. And I was out of my mind with having a good time. And then I put up a real antenna. And it was like night and day. A real antenna, I think I might have put up like a 40-meter dipole or something. And the signals were coming in way stronger like I never heard before. So what I'm trying to say is the perception of a person as to what kind of antenna you have, you really got to compare it to something else. Because you could get easily satisfied with an antenna. And then, like I said, I put a real antenna up and it was night and day. So, of course, what I'm also saying is that Waters B&W antenna, which was sold to the military, the military didn't care. They were running 500-watt transmitters and so on, so they could lose a couple hundred watts and not worry about it. But it was a realization to me that, that was not a good antenna. And nothing like a real antenna, net control. Go ahead.
AC2GS. Well, I completely agree with you, Chet. There's the old saying, ignorance is bliss. So if you don't realize how bad your antenna is, it's probably for the best, unless it limits you from getting a decent antenna. Because, ultimately you feel good about yourself, and that's a very important thing as well. But, yeah, it's very difficult to gauge. I mean, I've repeatedly said that the reason why, in my humble opinion, amateur radio operators fixate on standing wave ratios is because that's the only thing that for $100 you can get a meter that tells you what it is. Otherwise, if we, God forbid, if we had a meter that read out the efficiency or read out or graphically showed the field strength in three dimensions, most of us would be deeply, horribly depressed with the numbers that we got back. So we fool ourselves with tweaking the impedance and calling it a day. So, yeah, I agree with you. All these things are very, very relative. every day and every frequency, and propagation conditions change, and it's the variability of all these things, and the fact that, you know, when propagation is in your favor, you can get away with an antenna that's sitting on the ground sometimes.
One more thing, Les, then. It's something I ran into back in 1992. I moved into a local locality in Long Island. I didn't know it, but the fire chief at the time was my next-door neighbor. And I, unbeknownst to him, to me, that he was the fire chief and knew everybody in town, I went to the buildings department and applied to put up a ham radio antenna. So the next thing I knew, there was two public hearings, but I did one, went on the second one. But anyway, the first meeting in the town hall, there were 60 people against me and nobody for me. And the fire chief came up, he went up to the microphone and he told everybody he has a ham radio friend and all he needs is a light bulb. And he gets out all over the place. So I don't know why this guy needs an antenna, because my friend says he can talk around the world on a light bulb. Over.
Yeah, I often tell the story. It's in one of my books. A guy who later on went into designing, manufacturing, selling sophisticated antennas as a kind of an experiment, I guess, to see what the determination will provide. He apparently, the story goes, he took a 100-watt incandescent light bulb, he put it on a 5-foot wooden fence post, and I think a 100-watt transmitter, and he eventually got it worked all states on some band or other. So, yeah, I mean, if you really want a challenge, you could use light bulbs. But, you know, life is a little too short for two big challenges. So, yeah, there's always got to be some smart aleck who just kind of louses everything up for the rest of us, right?
The time, he hated me. He wasn't not happy with me. He wasn't happy with me for years. He would scowl at me when I came home from work. But one day, there was a hurricane in one of the Caribbean islands. I don't know the name of it. I'm just going to name it like an Antigua or something like that, but it wasn't that. And so I didn't even speak to the guy. All he did was scowl at me when I came home. He'd stand outside and look at me, face me down. Because I got permission from the local town to put up my antenna. Right. So anyhow, he knocked on my door after 5 years with another gentleman, and he said, "Hi, Chet. Could you do me a favor?" So I said, "What is the favor? Let me let it drop." He says, "This is Al or somebody, whatever the name was, Joe, Al, Bill." And he says, "His daughter just got married, and they went down to this certain island in the Caribbean. The hurricane came, and nobody can communicate from the island. The island was completely knocked out. All communications, telephone lines, there was no way to communicate from the island. Do you think that you could find out anything about the island and if his daughter was safe on the island?" Well, I went to 20 meters. I said, "I'll let you know in a couple hours." I went to 20 meters, and just by luck, on the hurricane net, I heard this guy on the island on a battery-operated station, and he was saying that everything is all devastated, all the trees are down, all communications is down. Let me let it drop. And, a cruise ship, he found out a cruise ship is coming in the afternoon, and he has heard that all the visitors to the island are safe, and they've been invited to the cruise ship, and they're going to use the international satellite phone on board the ship, and you're going to probably hear from your daughter this afternoon. Well, anyway, I went next door. I was just receiving. I didn't even talk to the guy. I was just listening with headphones, and I went next door. I told the fire chief, and like a long story short, sure enough, the guy gets a phone call from his daughter that afternoon, and so from that moment, ham radio operator next door, he was well regarded. Go ahead.
Well, I'm certainly glad it ended well and that you were able to do that and hopefully impress this guy. I think there's more than a few hams in the metropolitan area that would have gone inside their house for a moment and returned to the gentleman and offered him a 100-watt incandescent light bulb and suggested he do it himself.
I didn't think of that, but that's a very good idea, Roy. Very good, Roy. Wow, yeah. See you later, WB2HK.
Okay, very good, Chet. Very good story. I liked it, especially it had a happy ending. Everyone was safe, and the fireman's friend got to find out that his family was safe. So I thank you for that, Chet. Frank, I guess it's your turn now.
Yes, WB2BXO here. Yeah, it is kind of amazing that people love ham radio in emergencies like that, and then they want us to disappear. They somehow don't realize that, it's a bit like the cops or the military, perhaps, that in order to offer this service, we have to be able to practice and use our antennas. We can't just miraculously sprout antennas in an emergency and know how to operate, know about radio propagation and how to contact islands that are in trouble, et cetera, and just do it without being on the air regularly and practicing and being ready. It's just like the cops or the military or the fire department or anyone else just aren't ready for an emergency without practice. Anyway, I'll step down from my soapbox. I have two questions. One is about FT8. And I know how much you love FT8, but somebody here might have the answer to this one. Is how do I recognize whether a station is in Foxhound mode or whether a DX station is in FH mode rather than regular FT8 mode, so I know which mode to switch to. I'm sure there's a simple answer to this one, and I thought of it today. I figured I might as well ask you before I spend the time to look it up. Another question is, I just got on Prime Day, I ordered a four-pack of Apple AirTags, and I was wondering if any of you guys have used them, have an idea, first of all, how useful they've been to you, and second of all, just what the technology is. I know it's more sophisticated, I think, or something different than the traditional RFID technology, because I've heard of people putting them in their luggage and then finding their luggage in Bangkok, Thailand, when the airline was saying they have no idea what happened to it. So take them in whichever order you wish, Roy. And if you don't have time for both, that's fine. Go ahead.
Okay, no problem. AC2GS. Unfortunately, not. I don't have enough knowledge to really speak too much on it. As far as I'm aware, the last time I looked into FT8, I did not see a Foxhound mode. When did this come into being?
None of the DXers on frequency are familiar with that. All right, I guess unless I'm not leaving a long enough pause, I'll have to stop being lazy and look up how to recognize it. Apparently, it's a common mode used by DX expeditions to work a lot of stations more quickly than in regular mode. I think it leaves out part of the regular exchange or something. Not quite sure how it works. So go ahead, Roy.
Oh, okay. I learned something new every day, I guess. I'm Googling it. There is apparently a YouTube on the subject. There is a settings on the FT8 software that you can decide to go Foxhound NAVHF contest, AORL field day. So special operating activity generation of FT48 and MSK-144. So it's sort of how it indicates to go into these fox and hound modes. I'm not quite sure. I'm quickly rifling through the page that I'm looking at to see if it's a particular has an indicator. Offhand, I can't recognize any kind of indicator on the software for when that's happening. But that's just a quick glance at what's going on here. If anyone else out there, because FT8 is a relatively popular piece of software. I've played with it in the past. I like rag chews. It's not really convenient for rag chews. So if anyone knows about the fox and the hound settings, how you recognize them on the other side, please let us know.
All right, I guess I'll go look at the YouTube. Go ahead.
That's always the best. The problem with amateur radio YouTubes is, unfortunately, about 50% of them are nonsense. Unfortunately, although they're hams, their respect for audio quality seems to be questionable. A lot of them will talk to a camera, a microphone that's in the camera, that has a zoom lens that's, 8 feet away from you, so there's a lot of ambient noise, there's a lot of really bad cuts or the lack of cuts, so give it a try. Worst comes to worst, you'll just be amused by some people's marginal incompetence.
Yeah, there's a whole lot to making YouTube videos and doing it well. And I was just telling my wife that there are some people on LinkedIn who are apparently have some at least good side hustles, if not actually making a living teaching people how to do YouTube videos effectively. Okay.
Yeah, I hope someday these guys will care and learn how to do things correctly. Getting to the Apple AirTags, I never owned any. I've read about them back and forth. My understanding is that it works on the basis of near field NFC capable smartphones, and it kind of taps into their GPS and then sends a message back, I guess, to Apple, where you can keep an eye on where the AirTag is going. So although the AirTag is only capable of very NFC near field type of interactions, people with cell phones are all over the world. So as long as you got some guy with a cell phone in his pocket and he passes by your AirTag, that's where it gets pinged and where you can look it up on Apple's website, as far as I'm aware.
That is really interesting. Okay, now I get it, why people feel comfortable putting them in their airplane luggage then, because it's not actually actively emitting a cell signal then. It is a near-field device similar to RFID then. I looked at a Bluetooth video before I bought them and said, okay, I think I can figure out how to set this thing up. I didn't want to buy something. I didn't want spend $90 on a gadget. I didn't have the vaguest idea how to use. Anyway, thanks a lot, and I will look at the FT8 FH mode videos on YouTube and see if I get a better understanding of how to recognize when a DX station is running in Fox mode. Let's see for the moment, Roy, BB2BXO.
AC2GS. Okay, very good, Frank. Also, AirTag does have Bluetooth capability, so it can operate, I think, both as a passive device if it gets close enough to another NFC detector, or if it's a little bit farther away on some kind of timed interval, no doubt, it'll just pulse out a Bluetooth signal. So it has active and passive capability. Again, as far as I'm aware. Not an expert because although I read a little bit about it, I never actually invested in one. It's enough our cell phones track us, and, you know, I'm waiting for my pencil to be able to be tracked. I have an iPad, a pencil that every so often gets lost, and I would love for a way of knowing exactly where that is. But who knows? Maybe the next iOS version will have that as well. So thank you very much, Frank. Anyone else with any questions or comments or subjects for tonight?
Yeah, what I want is an AirTag type gadget small enough to attach to my wife's hearing aids, because those are real easy to lose and real expensive to lose. Okay, like WB2BXO thing.
Yeah, size and battery life are the two important aspects to this type of technology. Eventually, if they could completely do away with the Bluetooth and have it purely as a passive device, and if they could shrink it small enough, then that would sell a lot. I mean, unfortunately, no matter what you do, you're kind of stuck with what do you do about people who use tools for nefarious purposes. There have been a lot of stories of trackers, stalkers rather, who track their obsession with people with no good plans for them. So like any tool, unfortunately, you could misuse them. But that's going to be the ongoing exercise of micro miniaturization. People are going to look for a smaller and smaller version of the AirTag. They did the same thing with cell phones, but cell phones have a practical, mechanical, tactile necessity to be a certain size. If you shrink them too small, their functionality is impacted, whereas a tracker, it's only improved because it's small, it's light, it'll go on more objects. So we'll see. I'm sure they're going to work on it, and I'm sure it's going to shrink through time.
Yeah, anyway, they seem like really clever and really useful gadgets. Anyway, I'll let you know what happens once I activate them and try them out a little bit, Roy.
Okay, have fun, and report back here. Let me throw out a subject. It's been a popular subject for the last few weeks, and I'm sort of surprised no one's brought it up tonight, and that's the unfortunate Titan submersible. People have combed through the dialogue that went on the mothership. And apparently everyone's conclusion, as far as I am aware, is that at a certain depth, their sensor devices started to flash red alert. So they tried to terminate the tour. They were only somewhat halfway down, so they tried to ascend up. And their electronics got a little wacky. They were only able to raise themselves a pittance, something like 60 feet. So they were trying to figure out what was going wrong as the alarm bells and the red lights were flashing. And at that point, the electrical systems completely failed, and they lost touch with the mothership. Apparently, what then happened is the submersible started a uncontrolled dive. And because for some strange reason All the passengers, I guess, wanted to look out the window. Everyone moved to that end of the submersible, which debalanced it and made it kind of like a falling rock. And it just kind of tipped on its side, the glass window at the bottom, and started to really plummet at a really unhealthy speed, such that eventually the pressure seals burst and the submersible imploded. And that was pretty much the end of that. So it was, you know, exactly where the failure, whether the failure was just within the entirety of the carbon fiber shell, which had cycled apparently 13 or 14 submersions in its lifetime, or whether the titanium ring that was attached by glue to the carbon fiber failed because they're different materials with different compression degrees of compression, so that the glue could have failed. The plexiglass could have failed. It wasn't really rated for that pressure anyway. So who knows? Any comments, or is everyone tightened out by now?
W2BZ.
Yes, Rich.
You know, I watched this documentary on James Cameron's submersible, and he spent years developing it with a team of like 50 people, and it's made like tons and tons of dives down to the Titanic. And I just don't understand how this guy developed the Titan with the minimum amount of testing and safety. I don't understand why he thought, and he was ridiculed in the industry before the accident happened. He was ridiculed. I read letters of people telling him to stop what he's doing. He's reckless. I don't know why this guy thought that he could make a submersible out of carbon fiber when nobody else had done that and get away with it. It was just, it's just mind-boggling how this guy put everybody, including himself, lives at risk.
Yeah, Rich, I agree with you. As I said, the death certificate should have been written cause of death, extreme acute hubris. He was just an arrogant guy. If you want to do something that's going to kill you, so be it. It's a free country. But killing other people, I have a problem with. And you could make a case, as I think we did last week, as the people did last week, that, you know, if you sign on and you're told that this is completely untested and this is completely, you know, guaranteed to kill someone eventually, then so be it. But, you know, I go back to this Pakistani kid who was fortunate enough to be born into the household of a billionaire from Pakistan. Unfortunately, that billionaire wanted to spend Father's Day in a death trap with his poor son that got him killed. So, yeah, I ultimately I don't understand it. I have a significantly different risk parameter than obviously this guy had. He just didn't believe in the concept of risk, apparently. I don't know.
Where were the regulators? You know, you can't build a spaceship without it being regulated by the FAA or whatever. Where was the regulators? And aren't there regulations when you build something like this?
In a word, no. The sky is completely different than the ocean. The sky is very regulated because a lot of countries have a lot of flying things all over the place that they would prefer.